provided by Thomas Allgaier and Frenes, based on this relevant LinkedIn post about private equity in CW 4041. Frenes specializes in B2B market research for private equity teams to drive portfolio performance and value creation. This edition is brought to you by our partner, Informa. Don't miss out on their upcoming conferences, Super Return Middle East, taking place between 21-23 October, and Super Return Europe, taking place between 4-7 November 2025. Find the links to both conferences in the description. Welcome back to The Deep Dive. Today, we're cutting through the noise, synthesizing the top private equity trends we saw buzzing around LinkedIn over calendar weeks 40 and 41.
Yeah, think of it as the highlights reel. We're giving you the shortcut, basically, so you're instantly up to speed on where the smart money seems to be focused.
And if we had to boil down everything we saw, the big picture, it's this. The industry is really undergoing a foundational shift.
Absolutely. The old playbook, you know, relying heavily on financial leverage, riding that multiple expansion wave, it feels like that's being, well, retired.
That's exactly right. The core conversation has just pivoted entirely. It's less about engineering the balance
sheet. Much less.
And much more about engineering, you know, repeatable, scalable, intrinsic business value. So our mission today is really to nail down where that new alpha is truly being generated.
And spoiler alert, it's all about operations. Let's maybe dive into that first major theme, this fundamental shift towards operational excellence as the new standard playbook.
Right. We've heard talk about this for years, obviously, but the data now seems to confirm the transition is, well, pretty much complete. Kevin McAllister's analysis, for instance, showed that revenue growth is now accounting for roughly 54% of value creation in PE deals.
54%.
Which makes it the single largest driver.
Yeah. And that's a staggering figure, isn't it? Because it really proves Sean McGrath's point. The game has definitely shifted from, you know, making money on favorable entry and exit multiple.
Financial engineering bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To making money on margin expansion and genuine organic growth. And that requires a different kind of rigor, a completely different level of diligence.
It also means firms are proactively looking at, let's say, controllable risk. Christoph Joes made a good point that while most PE funds instinctively try to avoid operational risk,
sure, makes sense.
The funds that actually succeed in addressing and, you know, solving those core business problems, they're the ones generating those outside superior returns.
So leaning into the operational challenges is the edge.
If you can fix the weak spots, that's your actual edge, yeah.
And this focus leads directly to very specific, prioritized operational levers. Like when you're looking for that immediate, reliable uplift, Truman Fritz pointed out that pricing strategy really leads the value playbook.
Ah, pricing. Always a big one.
Consistently the fastest, most reliable path to immediate EBITDA improvement, according to him.
Okay, so pricing is the immediate lever. But what about those functions that maybe seem harder to directly monetize? Like customer support.
Yeah.
Philip Kraft made a really interesting, almost provocative argument there.
Yeah, he did, saying we shouldn't just view customer support as, you know, a necessary cost center.
Right.
He actually framed things like poor resolution times or outdated knowledge bases, not just as bad service, but as genuine EBITDA leaks.
EBITDA leaks. I like that framing.
Leaks that compound over time. So fixing those leaks, actually transforming customer support into a value retention mechanism, that's pure operational excellence. It ensures your customers stay profitable.
And if the main focus is on this kind of operational transformation, that obviously demands a very specialized workforce.
Mm-hmm.
Paul Press outlined the need for a specific sort of blended talent model to execute this new playbook effectively.
Right, you could almost call it a blended pyramid model. At the very top, you absolutely need those senior operating partners. They bring the, you know, the experience, the board level influence. They've set the overall strategic vision for creating value.
Okay, makes sense.
Yeah.
But those people are, let's be honest, expensive and pretty scarce.
Exactly. So the leverage, the real grunt work, comes from the base, the mid-level operating professionals.
Oh, okay.
They're the analytical engine room, as Press put it, providing the horsepower, the execution capacity you need to actually deliver that crucial 100-day plan. You really need both working together to generate repeatable alpha across a whole portfolio.
Which brings us quite neatly to our second big theme, the human factor.
Yeah.
Because in this operational era, the quality, the preparedness, the alignment of your talent, it's just non-negotiable.
Absolutely critical.
And we're seeing a definite change in what risk means during due diligence, particularly in those very human-centric sectors like professional services.
Mm-hmm.
James O'Dowd pointed out the funds are, quite rightly, getting wary of just templated reports.
The check the box stuff.
Yeah, because in these service industries, the biggest risks often aren't purely financial. They're human. We're talking culture clashes, employee sentiment, talent flight risk, that kind of thing.
Which demands deep primary diligence focused on the people, not just staring at the spreadsheets. And, you know, this raises the bar significantly for anyone stepping into C-suite roles in PE-backed companies.
Definitely.
Maxwell Salazar, who comes at this from an IO psychology perspective, really stressed that preparedness now centers on genuine self-awareness and, importantly, accountability, moving past just listing generic strengths.
Okay, but hold on. Aren't self-awareness and accountability kind of management buzzwords we hear all the time? What does Salazar actually mean in the context of, say, a PE C-suite that has to deliver radical change in, like, 100 days?
Fair question. He means proven differentiated value. You need to be able to clearly articulate the unique contribution you bring. But crucially, you also have to be transparent about past failures and what you genuinely learned from them.
Ah, the failure part. That's key.
It is. He noted that if a candidate can't name a mistake or gets defensive about it, that lack of trust becomes a major liability when the board inevitably challenges them. And when that trust is gone, well, Salazar says the writing is pretty much on the wall.
Makes sense. This demand for quick, high-impact operational change also seems to highlight the strategic use of interim leaders. Jennifer Brooke Botfield ran a poll showing, get this, 63% of respondents view operational efficiency as the top priority where these interims really excel.
Yeah, and Bjorn Henriksen echoed that point. He noted that these leaders aren't just, you know, seat warmers until you find a permanent hire.
Not just a stopgap?
No, they're seen as strategic catalysts for transformation. They provide high-impact leadership, essentially leadership as a value creation tool, but without the delay you get with a long-term executive search. It's about immediate, dedicated expertise hitting the ground running.
And then finally, staying on the human side, there's the rarely discussed but potentially massive risk of succession. Hassan Kaiser highlighted the leadership transition over at 7-2. He used to be Apax Partners France, remember?
Yes, between Eddie Mizrahi and Thomas de Villeneuve.
Exactly. And that stood out because it was such a rare example of really intentional, transparent succession planning, communicated years in advance to LPs, to stakeholders.
You're active, not reactive.
Precisely. To ensure total continuity. It was handled like a planned strategy, not like putting out a fire.
Okay, so let's maybe pivot now. Let's turn our attention to the technological foundation underpinning this new operational era, theme 3, the AI and technology revolution, which I think we can agree is clearly moving past the buzzword stage now.
Definitely feels that way. It's becoming a core process driver.
Yeah, and Francois Candelan articulated the significance really well, calling AI a true industrial revolution. He compared its potential impact to, like, electricity.
Wow, that's a big statement.
It is. But for PE, he stressed the focus isn't necessarily on chasing the next tech unicorn. It's more about harnessing AI to drive operational excellence and, crucially, margin expansion within their existing portfolio companies.
And you can already see its impact in the diligence and deal cycle, right? Donald Zamborano and several others emphasize AI's power to rapidly analyze these massive data sets.
Which just accelerates everything.
Accelerates diligence, helps scale deal volume, lets firms move with, well, unprecedented speed sometimes.
Now, here's something interesting. We often assume, don't we, that AI delivers its highest ROI at the largest scale, that bigger companies with more data benefit the most.
Yeah, that seems logical.
But Elizabeth C. detailed the exact opposite happening in the mid-market. She highlighted PE-backed packaging companies, maybe around the $150 million revenue mark.
Okay.
Seeing higher ROI, like 9x plus, from AI deployment than much larger firms.
Really? Why is that?
The reason. They avoid the complexity tax.
The complexity tax.
Yes.
Explain that.
It's basically the organizational drag, the friction caused by years and years of fragmented, siloed, legacy IT systems that larger, older corporations inevitably build up.
Ah, the organizational scar tissue.
Exactly. The mid-market often doesn't have that deep-seated complexity, so they can deploy targeted AI solutions much more efficiently, much faster.
And get immediate results, like margin expansion. Arun Karthik-Ganesan provided some really tangible examples using a simple three-lens framework: user, process, and customer.
Okay.
He mentioned an industrial components maker cutting 3 full days off their month-end close just by using AI for invoice auto-matching.
Yeah.
It's instant operational efficiency right there.
Yeah, 3 days. That's significant, however. There's always a however, isn't there? Lee McCabe raised a really critical counterpoint about the risk this whole trend introduces to the traditional PE model itself.
How so?
He argued that AI is effectively coming for the moat being judgment and pattern recognition, which, historically, that was the elite currency of top PE partners, right? Their ability to spot things others missed.
Interesting point. So if AI can spot pricing anomalies or structural inefficiencies faster than a human expert, what is the human edge then?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If the machine handles the heavy lifting of pattern recognition, where should human insight focus?
Right.
Well, according to McCabe, the answer lies in context, creativity, and that cross-functional fluency, basically. The ability to ask better questions than the machine can even generate.
So it's about augmenting, not replacing.
Precisely. And Steve Budd confirmed this too. He noted that expert networks remain absolutely essential alongside AI because they provide that crucial real-world human judgment, the nuance, that models still can't replicate.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Let's pivot now to the broader picture, the macroeconomic environment, market signals. Our fourth theme. Are we still seeing significant challenges, particularly around liquidity and getting deals deployed?
Oh, absolutely. Especially when it comes to distributions back to LPs. Jan Voss shared some pretty sobering findings. PE investors are apparently seeing record lows in distributions right now.
Really? Record lows?
Yeah. We saw reports mentioning one family officer saying they're struggling just to maintain their position or even cover their capital calls.
Wow.
And the reasons cited were, you know, partly those high entry valuations from the 2019-2021 bubble period.
Still feeling that hangover.
And of course, the elevated interest rates on private credit. So yeah, exit constraints are definitely tight.
But okay, despite that tightness on the exit side, capital still needs to be deployed, right? There's dry powder. Hugh MacArthur highlighted a critical shift here. Public markets are increasingly becoming the new private club, effectively supplying inventory for the next buyout vintage.
So more public to private deals?
Seems like it. Investment activity tied to public companies has climbed to just over half of total PE activity now.
And that includes some absolutely massive headline-grabbing take-privates too. Nicola Ebmeyer pointed to the staggering example of Electronic Arts.
The EA deal, yeah, huge.
Structured with something like $20 billion in debt and $36 billion in equity, a $55 billion total deal value. That LBO just demonstrates the continued massive capacity of PE to deploy huge amounts of capital in the public sphere through these complex take-privates, PIPEs, carve-outs.
It's a really dynamic interplay going on. Hadrian Borelli's noted that even younger public companies are increasingly adopting practices we traditionally saw only in private firms.
Like what?
Like embracing tighter governance structures, more demanding management incentives, adopting those focused fundraising strategies common in PE. The lines between public and private governance are genuinely blurring.
Interesting. And finally, just quickly, as firms navigate this liquidity crunch and need to place their bets strategically, did we see any consensus on specific sector bets drawing attention?
We did, yeah. A couple stood out. Bruce Richards framed defense investment as mission critical, benefiting from compelling long-term fundamentals, steady cash flow. Makes it attractive in a volatile market, you see.
Stable and essential. Makes sense.
And then we also saw Jamie Smith and Brett Martucci highlighting energy utilities. Apparently being bought up pretty rapidly.
Utilities, why?
Driven primarily by the rising power demand from AI.
Ah, the AI connection again.
And the associated need for massive data center buildouts.
Yeah.
It really shows how technology infrastructure and traditional sectors are now fundamentally linked in PE strategy.
Fascinating stuff.
If you enjoyed this deep dive, new editions drop every 2 weeks. Also check out our other editions on venture capital, M&A, and strategy and consulting. So, all right, wrapping up this particular deep dive, the main takeaway feels pretty undeniable, doesn't it? Private equity is fundamentally changing its identity.
Yeah, it feels like it.
Moving from being perhaps just a provider of capital to becoming more of a core business architect. The focus is no longer if you use operational transformation or AI.
That ship has sailed.
Right. It's how you staff and lead the human teams around those systems to deliver genuine, repeatable value.
And I think the real challenge now for every firm is to look inward and seriously address that critical question Lee McCabe raised. If AI is rapidly commoditizing traditional pattern recognition and judgment.
The old edge.
The old edge, exactly.
Okay.
How is your firm ensuring its value creators, its people are focused on those truly differentiated human skills?
Yeah.
You know, the context, the creativity, the cultural alignment, things the machines simply cannot replicate. that feels like the new scarcity.
That is the new edge.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Don't forget to subscribe or follow for the next one.